or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. And now it's Art Focus with Joseph Galavan.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Galavan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Laura Muller. She's the curator of art at Portland Japanese Garden, and she's here to talk about Ishiuchi Miyako's show called Spirits Rising, which is running now through March the 15th. Thanks for coming back to KBOO, Laura.
Thank you, Joseph. It's always nice to be here.
So this is the first show you've actually programmed, right? You've been there a year, and you got your teeth into this show a year ago, and now here it is.
Exactly. I came here about a year ago, and one of the first sort of tasks that I was given was to start thinking about and proposing projects for our 2020 Year of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the inaugural show of our 2020 Year of Peace. And I immediately thought of Ishiuchi Miyako's work, Hiroshima. I came into her work after I saw a documentary of her called Things Left Behind, and it was a documentary of her work, the first time her work had been shown outside of Japan in Vancouver, Canada, back in 2012. And so I've always loved her work, wanted to work with her, and when this idea came up that I needed to find something for 2020, I immediately thought of Ishiuchi-san. Mm-hmm. And worked on getting her here.
So this is a kind of a subset of her Hiroshima photos. This is Spirits Rising. How many pictures are in the pavilion?
There are 33.
Mm-hmm.
Full and color, larger than life photos.
Yeah, yeah. So these are basically children's clothes taken from Hiroshima after the atomic bomb went off in August 1945. And so they're all kind of on white backgrounds. They're big. So little girls' dresses, but really big, blown up big. So you can see every thread. And then a lot of them are torn or stained or, you know, damaged in some way. But they're kind of, and they're all wrinkled as well. They've been in storage for years.
Exactly.
So what was her process of going through the archives?
Well, in 2007, she was commissioned to go to the Hiroshima Memorial Peace Museum. And this is extremely rare for an artist to be brought in to photograph these objects. All these objects are housed in the museum, and they were donated by loved ones of victims of the bombing 75 years ago. And so her idea was to take these things out and literally take them out into the light. These have been in storage, in dark storage rooms, packed up. Why? One of the reasons why they're so wrinkled and whatnot is, you know, they were packed, put away, and so she wanted to bring them out. So she brought them out into the light to give them voice.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of camera was she using?
She uses primarily, she, you know, used digital format, and it's very, a lot of them are, and she even uses a handheld camera at times as well, very different cameras. And she uses different cameras for the photographs, but some are just even using a handheld digital photo.
Mm-hmm. As you go in, I kind of walked around the pavilion in a clockwise fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the left wall, as you go in, I think the third and fourth pictures are a little pink shirt, I suppose, like a girl's shirt, and the sleeves are torn. You can see in the shoulder, there's a sort of a shoulder pad. It's mm-hmm. a hand-sewn piece of padding that's exposed. And then a big part of the left side of the shirt is all brown.
Right.
And then next to that, there's a girl's dress, and it's almost translucent. It's so thin. It's like cheesecloth, but it's blue. So the light is shining right through it. And obviously where there are seams and the collar are very dark, but most of the dress is, you know, just almost like paper. It's so thin.
Mm-hmm.
So these things make you immediately think of the vulnerability of the person who was wearing them on that day. But then there are these big brown stains on things. What do you think that is?
Well, a lot of those things, I mean, these are objects that were worn and experienced the bombing. So that's one of the things that she was really conscious about, is she wanted objects that, you know, when the focuses were finding objects that showed the results of the bombing. And the stains were, you know, there's bodily fluids, there's blood on some of them, there's dried blood, to show what, and then they're all tattered. So they show the force of the bomb and what transpired. And I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of they show you how fragile we are. You know, we get dressed, we go out for the day, and in a bomb of this caliber, there's no protection. There's no protection in these objects. We're born, and this is all that's left.
Mm-hmm.
After we experience something like this, the body's experienced something like this. This is what's left are these objects.
Yeah, there is a pair of socks. They're kind of like knee length socks,
mm-hmm.
Kind of indigo bluish and gray. So there's a lot of this indigo color in the clothing, and these socks just like look like kind of gray, you know, private school long socks,
right,
a boy
right.
might wear with shorts or a girl right. might wear, and they're kind of mottled with stains, and they have a sort of pinkish bleached out quality to them, and the tops are ragged. But do we know anything about these socks?
Well, it was interesting. The thing is something that Ishichi-san was really adamant about was there's no labels, as you noticed as you went through. There's no labels. She will not allow any labels. So you don't get any. She didn't want this to become an exhibition of documenting what was what had happened. That's what has, you know, that's what we know of so far. When you think of images from Hiroshima up to this point, we think of the grainy black and white bombed out photos of Hiroshima that the military took when they first went in, and she sort of wanted to reclaim this historical event and bring it back to a level of humanity, to the human level. It's not just numbers that died, but actual human lives that were lost, loved ones that were lost, and the experiences that they had. And these objects sort of speak to that. A lot of the objects show, you know, the terror of the bombing. They are tattered, they are stained. It's because this is what it caused. And this is all that's left. The bodies are gone. And a lot of these things came to embody the lives that were lost. The loved ones cherished these objects. These objects embodied these people, and after being cared for many, many years and being all that was left of these loved ones, the family decided that the best thing they could do was to give them up to the museum to hopefully help make sure that nothing this ever never happened again.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the real personal emotion that goes through all of these works, and it's hard not to be kind of really taken back by that. And mm-hmm. it really brings it down to the human level, the everyday human level. I mean, these are people just going about their daily lives that day when the bomb hit, and it was just this tragic, tragic event.
Yeah, it reminds me of the pictures I've seen of a children's playground there where the steel climbing mm-hmm. structure is all twisted.
Right.
So you get a sense of, you know, the force, but also who was affected. People were just out doing their thing. Nobody
exactly.
knew it was coming. There's a nice pair of pictures. One is a kind of polka dot shirt
mm-hmm.
with two big brown stains on it. And it's paired with a pair of strips of fabric. And one of them has two red buttons with kind of walls
buttons.
On
right,
them.
Right.
And then the other piece has a press stud or a snap, and it's a sort of plaid cotton fabric.
Right.
So she was in there, was she just picking up bits and pieces?
There's hundreds of objects in the collection. And she began by going through, they have a digitized database, which actually anyone can go to. If you go to the Hiroshima Memorial Peace Museum, anyone can look up the database
online,
and actually go online and you can see all these objects. you know, a lot of them, the descriptions, the titles of them are really kind of odd, you know, like torn shirt. Well, there's lots of torn shirts, torn short and blue. And so you do really need to just spend time to go through the images to see what's there.
You're talking about images the museum took of all this stuff?
Right. Before her. They've all been cataloged. Everything has been cataloged in the collection. And so that's how she started to find the works. And she built it, she went in and she spent days in the collection, with the collection, pulling objects, looking at the objects, and trying to hear what they have to say. It sounds a little corny, but it really was. She spent time with these objects and wanted to photograph these objects to give them voice, you know, bring them into the light. She really uses light in a powerful way in these images. There are a few works, as you notice, as you commented, Joseph, on that are actually using light boxes. So they're lit from behind to show the transparency of these beautiful dresses and things. But also others, she wanted to bring them into the light. And so a lot of the photography was done in a large windowed room. She used natural light. There were no artificial lighting used for a lot of the works, for most of the works. There's either the backlight or natural light were the two kind of sources of light that she used to photograph all of these objects. Also, I should say that these actually aren't all children's objects. These are adult objects as much as children's objects.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that is interesting, and as you'll notice in a lot of the marketing and whatnot, is the title of this series is called Hiroshima. And you see it written both in the Japanese hiragana syllabary as well as in Roman letters. And she was really, when she was thinking about this object, one thing that really struck her is that a lot of the objects that she was drawn to and that she photographed were objects for women, women's objects. And she looked for objects that had traces, or she knew, touched skin of people who had perished. So it was really important for her. And she thought, and she wanted to connect it to sort of the historical narrative of Japan. And so the hiragana characters, that writing system for Japanese, developed in the Heian period from the 18th and 9th, the 8th and 9th century. And it was a writing system that developed for the court women to write their poetry and diaries and correspondence, but it became known as onade, so the hand of women.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why she chose hiragana to write out the title of the series of Hiroshima.
Just tell us, how many scripts do the Japanese have?
There's three scripts. There's two syllabaries, the hiragana and then katakana, and then there's the kanji characters that come from the Chinese writing system.
So this one, the hiragana, would you see this in normal life walking around Tokyo?
Yes, you will. Because that's the first thing students of Japanese learn. So all children learn that this is the first thing that they learn is hiragana. So any child of age will know hiragana.
Mm-hmm. There's a pair of, they look like dungarees or they're trousers. Mm-hmm. They've got that kind of Casey Jones look. They're very stripey.
Right. I love that. That's one of my favorite pieces, actually. I think they're fabulous, right?
They're blue with a kind of yellowish stripe. But the crotch has this circular panel. Mm-hmm. So they've been sewn in a circle, I guess for reinforcement. But then, so they look kind of sturdy, like workwear. But then the destruction to them is just horrible. Like one side is completely mm-hmm. shredded and the inseam of the other leg is all shredded. Again, you get this sense of force.
Right.
And also, you don't know, some are men's trousers.
No, they weren't. I was just going to say this. This is what's so exciting about this piece. Is I, too, thought, oh, here's a piece where actually she's actually showing men's trousers. They are not. These are actually, were pants that were worn under kimono for women who were working working or had to be active. These were actually women's pants that were worn.
Oh.
By them. So
like
some
working
women,
class?
Working class women would wear these exactly for, oh. Safety and just because the kimono, actual kimono robe would be difficult to work in, to move around and whatnot. So they would wear these trousers underneath the kimono. But those are actually women's pants.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Laura Muller. She's a curator of art at Portland Japanese Garden. She's here talking about Spirits Rising, a photographic show by Ishiuchi Miyako, and that runs through
March 15th.
Quickly tell us, there's a lecture on February 15th?
Yes.
Post-romantic mood.
Exactly. It'll be on Saturday the 15th at the Garden in the afternoon at 3 p.m. And we're bringing in one of the leading scholars of post-war Japanese photography, Kasahara Michiko. And she is the current vice director of a brand new museum in Tokyo called the Artisan Museum. It was formerly a museum, the Bridgestone Museum, a collection of mostly actually Western art. And they renamed, they built a new museum and sort of rebranded themselves and restructured the organization. So now it just actually opened this month to the public. It's called the Artisan Museum in Tokyo. But she's the vice director there, and she was formerly the chief curator at the Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography for many years.
Oh. And so a photo specialist talking about one of the great Japanese living photographers.
Exactly. So it's really exciting. We're really fortunate to have her here. They're actually very good friends, and that's one of the reasons that we got her to come here, is that when I told her that I wanted her to come and speak on Ishiuchi-san, she jumped at the chance and said, of course, I would love to come and speak about her work. So we've got her coming here February 15th, so we're really excited about that.
Well, tell us more about Miyako, because she's a big deal, and if you've never seen her pictures before, there's a book you can look at.
Right.
Tell us a bit about her.
I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, she first of all, is just an absolute rock star. She was here for the opening, and she was such a delight to work with. And she's done such amazing work. She's been the selected artist for the Japanese Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. So she's really has a really international name. In 2014, she was given the Hasselblad Award for Photography, which is one of the major international photography awards. And so she's recognized around the world as being this great, great photographer. And so we're so lucky that she's here at Portland. It was really interesting. She came in on the Monday before the opening, and she's very honest. And so she came on Monday, and she came directly to the garden, and she looked around, and which I didn't know until Tuesday, but she was really nervous that she had made a really bad decision to have her art shown at the Portland Japanese Garden.
Why?
Well, it's a garden, right? And this is a world-class international artist. And so why would this contemporary photography be shown in the middle of a garden, a traditional Japanese garden? But she came back on Tuesday. We started working on the installation, and Tuesday night we went out for dinner, and she was really sweet. She said, when she got there on Monday, she was really nervous that she had made a bad decision. But she said by the end of the day on Tuesday, after spending time at the garden, seeing the preparations that we had done for this exhibition, she said she was totally relieved and thought that this is the perfect place to show her art. So she became a real fan of the Portland Japanese Garden in Portland. So that was really exciting to see that.
So when Tatihana was here, he had a squadron of people,
right,
to install his work. He had a posse of five girls in black.
A small army of people here, yes, to install.
How
his
was
work.
The install for this?
Well, was this was meticulous? Interesting. It was Ishiuchi-san, and then it was her gallerist, Aya Tomoka, and who came with. So this is the two women who came over. But she was interesting because she wants to create, and as you noticed probably, Joseph, when you were there, it's not just going in to look at photographs. She creates a kind of it's an installation, really, using her photographs. She hangs her photos at different heights so that she wants it to be a physical experience. She wants her photos to become a physical experience for people, for viewers who come and see her work. So you have to bend down, you have to look up at certain things. You've got to go through the space. We created these really wonderful large triangular pillars in the gallery space, which we've never done before, to create this sort of these monumental pedestals to show her work, to hang her work. As you know, as you mentioned, these are really large scale, oversized, blown up, full color works of art. And we needed large surfaces to hang them on. So we created these large pedestals. And she's very hands-on in terms of the installation. And so we went around the room, each photograph, she found, you know, the place for it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she gave a lot of thought, and each one was very specifically placed throughout the gallery space.
Did you understand her placement philosophy?
Yes, because at the end, when you look at it, you're like, of course, this makes sense.
But it's not narrative.
It's not narrative, no. And there's no order as well. In fact, when she came, we had the layout of how the gallery space is going to, you know, how the surfaces where they were going to be hung, but we had no idea which photos were going to go where. Mm-hmm. We got the confirmed object list, but it wasn't, she wanted to be here to actually select each place. There was a perfect place within that gallery, in the gallery for each and every photo.
Were they printed in Japan and flown over?
Yes, everything was printed and framed and then sent here. Already printed and framed, and then that was hung. And it was interesting too. So, as you maybe have noticed when you were in the pavilion gallery as well, there are two of the side shoji doors, the sliding doors on the side. You know, this is a very traditional building, and the space is very traditional Japanese architecture. And two of the walls are just sliding doors, shoji paper doors, and then the window doors out into the garden. And after spending time and looking at the garden space, there's two sets of doors that are open to the glass. One is the entrance and exit to the pavilion gallery. And the second, she wanted open just because it has the perfect view of the flat garden in the garden. So she wanted to include this living work of art, the garden, in with her installation. And she was, we were supposed to have a panel within that, in that opening, where she'd be hanging more photography, but she said no photograph should go there. I want it open to the glass so people can see the actual garden where they're at when they see my photos.
Mm-hmm. There's a piece, it looks, I thought it was a pillow. It looks like more of that blue denim stuff, mm-hmm. but it has red roses printed on it. And what is it?
Yeah, there's two pieces that are similar to that. And what those are actually, they were bombing hoods. So these would be hoods that were out of fabric that were created out of, they were recycled kimono fabric. So they would become padded and people would wear them over their heads to protect them from bombing raids. Mm-hmm. Of course, with the atomic bomb and the radiation, there's, you know, the irony is that nothing's going to protect them from that, and these hoods wouldn't. But
during the war, the Americans were firebombing Tokyo,
right.
So there was bombing every night,
everywhere.
So
exactly.
It made sense to cover your head.
Totally, exactly. When they were out, you'd always have these with you, exactly.
But nobody knew what was coming.
No one knew that the atomic bomb was coming. No.
Some of these have a certain more pathos than the other. A little girl's dress with brown splotches, probably blood. I mean, we don't know. Could some of them just be water damage from being in a museum?
No, I mean, there's a possibility that there's other liquids in one, but a lot of it was just bodily fluids and blood. I mean, when people that actually lived through the actual bombing, their skin would melt it off at times, and mm-hmm. things, or they were actually hurt outside of the radiation as well, or blistered and things. So a lot of these are just bodily fluids and blood to show sort of the tragedy of this event.
There's one has a little badge on it, like like a school kind of. It's like a Gothic M, but it might be a school uniform.
It's a school uniform. There were multiple school uniforms because this was right. It happened in the morning. These were when kids were on their way to school. You know, this is like every other. This is just another day. In the life, and people were off doing their thing in the morning when the bomb hit. There's no pre-warning of this coming.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the biggest pieces is a girl's dress. It's kind of red and blue. Would you call that gingham? It's a very fine
gingham, or possibly a plaid almost.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one thing too that you'll notice as you walk through is a lot. Hiroshima was a coastal city, so it was a port city. And so it was one of these cities where there was a lot of import-exporting going on. And so Western, you'll notice that it's mm-hmm. kind of strange because obviously this is a Japanese city during World War II, but there's a lot of the clothing is actually Western clothing. Yeah.
There's one, it's a close-up of a label that says Nazareth, mm-hmm. U.S. patent pending, right. And the size and everything in English.
So it represents, you know, the location, Hiroshima, and being this sort of international city where a lot of people wore and were exposed to and owned and wore very Western clothing at this time.
Mm-hmm. So what have you got going on for the rest of the year in 2 minutes?
In 2 minutes. Well, this is our, like I said, year of peace. And so we've got 5 exhibitions. So following this, we've got the contemporary calligrapher Shoko Kanazawa coming. And then after that, we have a sculptor, Iwasaki Takahiro, who does these amazing architectural sculptures. And then we have a glass artist, Rui Sasaki, who is coming to do site-specific installations in the garden of glass art.
Oh, you mean around the garden, mm-hmm. out
There'll
in the weather?
Some in outside the buildings or in the courtyards as well, installation mm-hmm. pieces, but all site-specific installations of
these
this glass art.
Blown glass or some other kind?
There will be some blown glass, but a lot of it is in the kiln or it's fired in the ovens.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then our final exhibition of the year will be on Manzanar, one of the relocation camps during World War II. There were a lot of gardens that were created at the Manzanar. The Manzanar camp. And so looking at the role of garden and arts and crafts in the lives of the internees in the room.
And these were photographed?
And they were also photographed, right? So we're going to have objects of art and then also photographs. And we've got, and there are three, you know, major 20th century photographers, Ansel Adams, who was hired to go and photograph there. Dorothea Lange also was hired to go and photograph there. And then Toyo Miyatake, who is a Japanese photographer who was living in L.A., who had a very successful photography business in L.A. before he was interned there as well. And there's a wonderful story how he actually snuck in lenses to the camera that he used to take photos in the camp. And it's interesting because all three of those photographers, they all come at a very different perspective to the camp. So they all tell sort of a different story or different aspect of the camp. So overall, the exhibition, I think, is going to be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Laura Muller. She's the curator of art at Portland Japanese Garden. She was here talking about Spirits Rising, a photographic show on now in the Pavilion Gallery by Ishiuchi Miyako, and it runs through March the 15th. Thanks very much for coming back to KBOO, Laura.
Thank you, Joseph. Always a pleasure.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Whoa, 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 whoa.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least 6 nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been bandleader for jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Así que vamos a delirar, deliremos por un ratito.
escucharnos por ahí. Gracias.
Buenas tardes, esto es la programación en español de KBOO Portland. Nos escuchan a través de las ondas radiales del 90.7 FM en Portland, el 104.3 en Corvallis y el 91.9 en Hood River. También nos escuchan en cualquier parte del mundo por KBOO.FM a través de su celular, su computadora o su tablet y también por la retransmisión de radiohumedales.org. Esto es Buscando América, un espacio radial que promueve el cambio social a través de las artes, la música y las letras. Bienvenidas y bienvenidos y bienvenides. Yo soy Tania Gómez Daza y los invito a que nos acompañen los siguientes 90 minutos, donde los vamos a tener mi compañera Karen Torrente y yo muy atentos y entretenidos esta tarde. Por un lado, por una conversación que tuve con Ipsia Kister, terapeuta y canalizadora de energía. Esta tarde hablaremos sobre las violencias hacia las mujeres adultas mayores, hacia las viejitas, las abuelitas y desafortunadamente las olvidadas en algunos casos. Por eso esta tarde queremos hablarles a ellas y en general a esos viejitos y viejitas que sabemos que nos escuchan. Así que va un saludo bien especial para ellas y para ellos. Recordaremos también esta tarde el cumpleaños número 90 de Margot Glantz. Ella es escritora mexicana que hoy, 28 de enero, está llegando a sus 90 años. Así que felicidades a